Good evening, everyone, and a very warm welcome to the Shakespeare Theatre for tonight's event hosted by LSE Health. I'm Liz Stokoe, Professor in the Department of Psychological and Behavioural Sciences here at LSE, where I'm also Academic Director of Impact. And as well as welcoming you all here, the live audience in the theatre, I want to extend my welcome to future asynchronous audiences, since this event is going to be recorded and will hopefully be available in the coming days on the LSE Health website. So our event has the title, The NHS at 77, A National Treasure or a System in Crisis, an apposite title as this year LSE Health celebrates its own age with its 30th anniversary. So over the past three decades, LSE Health has established itself as one of the major contributors to the bridging of health research and policymaking in the world. Their work informs health policy decision-making at the highest national and international levels. They've received commendations from institutions and individuals at the pinnacles of academia and governance. Their contributions to health policy and practice have been recognised in numerous ways, and including, as a very notable part of their overall story, being the recipient of the highly competitive and highly prestigious Queen's Anniversary Prize for Higher and Further Education. So this timely public panel brings together LSE academics with clinical and policy experts to reflect on the status and the state of the NHS at a critical juncture in its history. We're going to hear from four presenters and our two discussants, who are going to talk, the presenters for around 15 minutes each and our discussants for around 5 minutes each. And we're going to start with Dr. Michael Anderson, who's going to talk about the enduring strengths and weaknesses of the NHS, which were identified during the LSE Lancet NHS Commission. We'll then hear from Professor Andrew Street, who will speak directly to the title of this event, The NHS at 77, Time for Retirement or Rebirth. Professor Alistair Maguire will then focus on 10 points that should have been incorporated into the NHS 10-year plan, built around the premise of social insurance as the source of funding for the NHS. And then Dr. Catherine Henderson will discuss the interface between health and social long-term care with a focus on England. And we'll then hear from our two discussants, Professor Sir Julian Legrand and Dame Jennifer Dixon. I'm going to introduce you to them each more fully as each takes the floor. And then after the presentations and responses, there'll be an open Q&A, so a chance for you all to ask questions, so do keep them noted as we move through the evening for that section towards the end. And then following the Q&A, LSE Health will be hosting reception on the 8th floor of this building, so everyone is invited to stay and meet our speakers upstairs. And if you're tweeting or Xing or blue skying or anything that you might be doing these days, the hashtag is LSE Health. Okay, so to start with then, Dr. Michael Anderson is Senior Visiting Fellow at LSE Health and a National Institute for Health Research funded clinical lecturer at the University of Manchester. He's also a general practitioner and practices 2 days a week in North Yorkshire. Michael has a PhD in health policy and economics from the LSE, focused on measures of healthcare quality in public and private hospitals in England. And he was one of the co-research leads for the LSE Lancet Commission entitled The Future of the NHS and was the lead author of the 2022 UK Health System in Transition report. He regularly collaborates with the European Observatory on Health Systems and Policies and worked as a technical advisor with the World Health Organization, the Organization for the Economic and Cooperation and Development, OECD, and the 2019 Romanian and 2023 Swedish presidencies of the EU Council. Dr. Michael Anderson will talk about the enduring strengths and weaknesses of the NHS which were identified during the Commission. And Michael, I invite you to walk across and the floor is yours.
Great, thank you. So I feel very privileged to be here, so it's a great honour amongst such esteemed individuals. I think it's a testament to LSE really that they gave me this role as co-research leader of the LSE Lancet Commission on the Future of the NHS. I would say at the time, I was relatively inexperienced as a researcher, but the department really pushed me forward and helped me develop as a early career researcher and a mid-career researcher. And this is just another example of how they're pushing for my development, and they give these opportunities to people throughout their careers. So I'm going to reflect on some of the main findings of the LSE Lancet Commission on the Future of the NHS. But these findings are not just unique to that commission. You know, they've been echoed in subsequent work, most recently, in the Darzi report and also the NHS Times Commission on the NHS too. And I think this will be a good kind of situational analysis that will just set the scene on, you know, on some of the main strengths and weaknesses of the UK health and care systems as I compare them to other healthcare systems internationally. Oh, I think this may not be working. Just press a bit harder. Okay. Okay, fantastic. Great. Okay, so one of the major flaws with the UK healthcare system performance is related to health outcomes. So this is across multiple dimensions. So looking at life expectancy, we know that the life expectancy in the UK is lower than the G7 average and the EU15 average. So when we compare, these are the set of comparators we used in the OECD Lancet Commission, a set of comparable high-income countries. And it's not just life expectancy, it's cancer survival as well. So in nearly all of the major cancers, the only exception is the leukemias, where we seem to do better. We have poorer five-year cancer survival. And this was emphasised in the Commission. The only exception is we tend to do better than the US in many of these outcomes. I'm not sure if that's something we need to be proud of, but you know, something at least. But also, one of the things that's driving these trends is we tend to have quite significant health inequalities in terms of life expectancy, healthy life expectancy, and they're widening over time. If you look at what's been happening, particularly since 2010 onwards, during the period of austerity and then subsequently the pandemic. And one of the things driving this is we have lower funding than many other G7 countries. The situation with funding has changed recently, actually. If you looked at what the figures that we had in the OECD Lancet Commission, we had funding just below the EU15 average, where now it's above. And that's because the funding has increased fairly substantially since the COVID pandemic. But this is just emphasises what we call this feast and famine approach to funding, where basically, instead of a long-term funding settlement with consistent increases in funding, we see quite significant increases followed by a stagnation of healthcare funding. So we've got the Blair years where we see 5-6% increases in real terms, followed by this period of austerity, and then quite significant increases in funding during the pandemic. And if you track back, you look that the average funding increases over time are roughly 4% in real terms. But the healthcare system would benefit from more consistency in funding at such a level rather than this so-called feast and famine. But the other element that's important to focus on is we've seen reductions in social care funding over the last 15 years. So if we look here, even though the absolute social care funding in terms of per person has now begun to reach the levels that we saw in 2009 and 2010 financial year, if you look at the real-time spending per person when you adjust it for age, which is a better measure of need for social care, we find that we still haven't reached levels of social care funding that were provided in 2009 and 10. So we have this situation where we have a different attitude towards funding in the healthcare sector and social care, despite how these two sectors are interlinked. When we look at staffing levels, we see an interesting situation where in many countries, you often find that if they have lower levels of physicians, they'll have higher levels of nurses. But the UK tends to be an anomaly in the respect that we have lower levels of physicians per thousand and lower levels of nurses. So we generally seem to have an understaffed healthcare system compared to other healthcare systems. And we argued in the Commission that this was largely due to ineffective long-term workforce planning. And that's that there's been a kind of lack of responsibility in trying to map what the demands are for our workforce and what the supply looks like. And this is exemplified when you start to look at some of the changes in nursing numbers. And shortly I'll show you what's happened with GPs and hospital consultants. So this is our nursing stock. And for a long time, there's been an imperative to try to push care away from the hospital and towards the community. But if you look at where we see the increases in adult nurses, we're seeing adult nurses increase over the last 15 years, and then children's nurses, these are inpatient children nurses. When if you actually look at the health visitors and the community health nurses, there's reductions. And it's the same as situation is seen when you look at mental health nurses, which seems quite, there seems to be a disconnect between what's happening with those nursing numbers and what's happening in terms of demand, because we've seen rates of mental health illnesses increase significantly over the last 5 to 6 years. The situation with GPs and consultants is quite shocking, to be honest. This is looking at the number of full-time qualified GPs and the number of registrar numbers. So the number of full-time qualified GPs in terms of full-time equivalents rather than headcount, which is important because there's an ongoing trend for GPs working more part-time, is we see that the numbers have actually reduced over the last decade. In contrast, if you look at the consultant numbers, so they say a 26% increase over the last 5 years, but there's actually, if you look at the 15-year trend, it's more like a 50% increase. So again, this doesn't match what the imperative from the policy perspective, which is to shift care towards the community. We just see an ongoing expansion of the hospital sector in terms of the workforce. So I come to the strengths because this is not just about bashing the NHS today. There are some benefits of the way that our healthcare system is structured and organised and financed and delivered. So we have quite an advanced approach to resource allocation at the national level. So since the 1970s, we've had this data-informed approach where we've measured healthcare needs due to a range of different factors related to local population demographics, like age, gender, comorbidities, previous healthcare utilisation, and as a result, we do see. Generally, people have argued that our approach to resource allocation is quite robust, and when you combine that with a system where there is where there's very little catastrophic health expenditure and poor user charges, we see the system and broad-based general taxation. We see a system that facilitates redistribution from the rich to the poor and from the healthy to the sick. And I'll talk more about that later. Also, most people would argue we can be proud of our approach to health technology assessment in that we were the advocates of the quality adjusted life year, which yes has flaws, but nonetheless, if you look broadly at the work of NICE, it can be argued that this leads to quite a robust and transparent approach to health technology assessment. And we've often led the world in this respect, and many other countries have adapted some of the methodologies and techniques that have been developed in this system. Also, others have argued that NICE and the approach to estimating quality adjusted life years has been used as an effective negotiating technique to try to keep some prices down. And broadly, if you look at our pharmaceutical spending as a proportion of total health spending, it is lower than many other comparable high-income countries. And we have a range of different mechanisms acting together because it's not just about new drugs, it's also about generics and existing drugs. And we have a very high generic prescribing rate, and we have mechanisms in place to competitively tender generics. You can argue there's flaws to that, which it does drive shortages to some extent, but generally we're quite good at generic prescribing, and it's emphasised very strongly in medical school. The story with health outcomes isn't all bad. We do have comparatively better performance in a range of different chronic disease outcomes. So this is congestive heart failure admissions. You can see here the UK has one of the lowest rates in EU15 and G7 countries. We also have quite good, quite low rates of things like diabetes-related amputations. The exception to this is we have quite high rates of asthma admissions. But generally, people have argued that our better performance in chronic disease outcomes comes down to the fact that compared to other countries, we still have a relatively strong primary care system. Yes, those numbers have been dropping for many years, but we still do have higher rates of general practitioners per capita than other countries, and we also have good data systems in primary care to monitor and track outcomes and incentives in place to track process measures to improve our performance for these chronic disease outcomes. having an NHS, a centralised, organised NHS, where the hospitals share similar institutional behaviours and cultures, and does foster collaboration between hospitals, and also our strong education sector and reputation of our universities, and strong and pathways for developing clinical academics, have all contributed to a system where we still punch above our weight in terms of clinical trials, although that has been changing in recent years. But one example of how we operationalised such infrastructure was the recovery trial, which is an example of a world-leading clinical trial which had significant impacts on COVID mortality globally. A major strength of the NHS is the fact that, yes, we do have user charges. There's no healthcare system that doesn't have user charges. We do have user charges for prescriptions and for, optometry services, for example. But we still have lower levels of user charges than many other systems. And if you look at the catastrophic health expenditure in the UK compared to other countries, we have one of the lowest rates internationally. And this comes back to that earlier point. When you have broad-based progressive taxation financing our healthcare system, where we're taxing the rich more than the poor, and we also have a resource allocation system that does give more resources to the healthcare sector in areas of higher need, which inevitably often end up being areas of higher deprivation, combined also with low levels of catastrophic health expenditure, we have a healthcare financing system that does facilitate redistribution from the rich to the poor and the healthy to the sick. And it has been described by Richard Titmuss that you can look at the NHS as an island of universalism in the UK. And if you look at how comprehensive the NHS is compared to other aspects of the welfare state, like, for example, education, where there's quite a large private sector, you could still argue that it's relatively more comprehensive. Although, crucially, some of these principles are being eroded in modern times. We are seeing things being removed from the NHS benefits package, and we are seeing an increasing role of the private sector in reference to privately funded care. So whether or not this point is still the case is up for debate. Thank you.
Okay, next up then is Professor Andrew Street, and he is the Head of Department of Health Policy at LSE. Prior to September 2017, he was at the Centre for Health Economics at the University of York, which he joined in 1999. And at York, Andrew was the Director of Health Policy Team and the Director of the Economics of Social and Healthcare Research Unit, a collaboration with the Personal Social Services Research Unit here at LSE, as well as a collaboration with the University of Kent. Andrew has published very widely on topics including health system productivity, hospital efficiency, performance measurement, patient-reported outcomes, and integrated care. He's worked for health ministries in England and Australia and was the editor of the Journal of Health Economics between 2006 and 2018. And Professor Street will speak directly to the title of this event, The NHS at 77, Time for Retirement or a Rebirth. Andrew, the floor is yours.
Great, thank you very much. That one? Yes, is it working?
Very good.
Excellent, that's good. So, 77th birthday of the NHS. I bought a little cake. God's got a little mess here. I was going to bring a candle as well, but health and safety. And the NHS actually isn't doing too well on either health or safety, unfortunately. There's about 7.5 million people waiting for treatment now, the highest in NHS history. Life expectancy for men and women is lower than it was before the pandemic. Admittedly, that's not all the fault of the NHS. The NHS often is picking up the pieces for the rest of our societal failures, and after quite some years of austerity, all of those social determinants of health that impact positively on our health have been undermined. So that's not all the fault of the NHS that these things are happening, like our life expectancy is declining. But, most of our measures of NHS process and outcomes are worse than they were, as Michael has just shown us. Safety, though, should be the preserve of the NHS. And unfortunately, what we seem to find is tragedies and scandals are ever present in the NHS. Bristol Royal Infirmary, mid-staffs, Morecambe Bay, Councils of Chester. Just this morning, they've announced an investigation into deaths following heart operations in Castle Hill Hospital in Hull. So safety is an ever-present concern in our NHS, and that is the responsibility of our health service. And, you know, all of those things taken collectively are just adding up to people being disillusioned and dissatisfied with the service. 2010, highest levels historically of patient satisfaction with the NHS. 70% of us were saying we were satisfied. Today, 20%. Right? A complete collapse. People are saying they can't rely on the service. People are thinking, and people here maybe, people at LSE are saying, look, I can't get my treatment when I need it. I'm not sure it's going to be high quality if I do it. I'm going to look for treatment outside, abroad. People are going abroad to get treatment. That includes our students. Our students who are coming to England on temporary visas and having to pay an NHS surcharge of £1,000 nowadays. Don't even use that in the NHS because they can't get care, so they get treated outside. So all of these things are adding up to a system that simply isn't serving the population. And it didn't have to be like this. How did we get here? We were promised jam tomorrow. We were promised if you vote to leave the European Union, there will be three... I can't laugh about it. We were promised £350 million a week to spend on the NHS. We were promised sunny uplands. We were promised orchards of magical money trees. And what have we got? We're investing in rockets and bombs instead of kidney machines. This is disappointing. I've got some more things to say. There is supposedly a plan, right? We have a Labour plan. And what they're saying is there are going to be three strategic shifts. What we're going to have is we're going to have a move from shift one, analogue to digital. We're going to move from the hospital into the community, and we're going to move from a focus on sickness into prevention. So all of those things are laudable aims. I'm sure that you all agree with them. They are good things, just as we all agree that we should all give peace a chance. Great ideas. And the trouble is, they're not new. There's nothing radical about those things. Analog to digital. Well, people talk about a digital revolution, but these things have happened over a long period of time. And we do things in a digital fashion. So what is the big new idea that is being promised with the analog to digital promise? What's the big new idea with moving people out of hospitals to communities? We've been talking about that for years, since the foundation of hospitals. And I looked it up on Wikipedia. Apparently, because that's what I do in my research, apparently it was Benjamin Franklin in 1736 who said, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. Most of us don't even know what pounds and ounces are now. Right? These have been said for years and years and years. So there's nothing new in those sorts of plans. Also, they're really vague and imprecise. How are we going to know what actually is being promised? How are we going to be able to quantify that those promises have actually been delivered? Because they're so vague, I wonder whether that's one of the reasons why the promised Darcy report prescribing what we need to do and how these things are going to be put into action has been delayed from the spring to this month to after the spend budget. when is this grand plan going to emerge? Instead, other things have been going on. There's been a big reorganisation. NHS England is being abolished, apparently because there's a duplication of services. But of course it's because Wes Streeting, the Secretary of State for Health and Social Care, wants to take back control of the National Health Service. So that's one thing, big change, headline figures, abolish the NHS. But then there's also rumoured to be another reorganisation that's going on as well. Reorganisations of the local boards that look after things at geographical level. This again is not new. The 1970s, the 1980s, the 1990s, we were ever changing from area health boards into local health boards and inventing new ones, merging them and so on. So the numbers were changing all the time. By the end, when Labour came to power, there were 95 local health authorities still standing. Labour abolished them and said, what we need to do is we need to bring care closer to local populations. So instead of local health authorities, they introduced 481 primary care groups. And then over time, they merged, they changed their name, their letterheads, and over a few years, we ended up with 152 primary care trusts. And then Andrew Lansley became Secretary of State for Health under the new coalition and said, let's get rid of primary care trusts and introduce another set of organisations. And we'll call those clinical commissioning groups. And we'll have 211 of them. And over time, then they reduced that number down to 135. And then in 2022, we introduced integrated care boards. And there were 42 of them. And 42 is the magic number. It's the answer to life, the universe, and everything. So we should be there, right? But no, we're not there. Because now Wes Streeting says, ICBs need to reduce their running costs by 50%. So we're going to have another new number. It might be 21, it might be 25, it might be 28 strategic health authorities, which is the number that we had when Labour were last in power. We're just changing the numbers all the time. Another re-disorganisation of the National Health Service. And it's really distracting. And it's taking attention to these true underlying problems that we have in our health service. And, you know, we're being told that there's no money. There's now, we're far from having magic money trees, we have a 40 billion black hole. There's no money left. There's no cake. We can't eat it. It doesn't exist. There's nothing. So, look, you know, I feel a little bit disillusioned. I'm a bit pessimistic about the future. And just for the avoidance of doubt, I truly am. How did we get ourselves into this situation? It's really disappointing that from a service that was running pretty well, it's just been hollowed out completely to where we are now. And there doesn't seem to be a big plan to sort things out. But there is a ray of hope. There's a knight in shining armour. It isn't Wes Streeting. It isn't Keir Starmer. But what he's going to do is he's going to set us to rights. He's going to set out a 10-point plan for what the NHS needs to do. And Liz is going to introduce to you a man we've known for all these years, Professor Ali Maguire, who's next up.
Professor Alistair Maguire is Chair of LSE Health and Chair of Health Economics at the Department of Health Policy here at LSE. And prior to this, he was Professor of Economics at City University London after being a tutor in economics at the University of Oxford. Professor Maguire has also been a visiting professor at many universities around the world, Harvard, University of Sydney, University of York, and Universitat Pompeu Fabra Barcelona. And he's pursued his interest in the economics of healthcare for over 30 years. His research covers all topics in health economics, including international comparisons, economics of the hospital, the public-private sector interface, cost-effectiveness analyses of health technologies, and health economics alongside clinical trials. He's also acted as an advisor to many governments and governmental bodies, including the UK government and the UK Competition Commission, the Medical Research Council, and the German Institute for Quality and Efficiency in Healthcare. And he's also advised many international bodies, including the World Bank, the World Health Organization, and the International Monetary Fund, as well as pharmaceutical and healthcare insurance companies. That's a lot of stuff. You're going to talk about 10 points that should have been incorporated into the NHS 10-year plan, built around the premise of social insurance as the source of funding for the NHS. Alistair, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much. And with friends like those. things were better, as Andrew. I'll pick up a number of themes that both our speakers have made points on. Things were better. They used to be better. I can certainly remember when they were better. And I think one of our best prime ministers, who probably didn't get long enough in the post, and certainly chancellors of the Exchequer in charge of the Treasury, you know, he pointed out that the NHS has been good and has stood the test of time. I'm an economist by training, and I like to remind a lot of people in the audience who are my students that healthcare is really all about insurance. Those of you who work in the healthcare sector, you're all actually in the insurance sector. You're providing the benefits of insurance. So if you start thinking about healthcare as being an insurance sector, it kind of makes you step back and think about the problems. We've heard a lot about the problems. I'm going to give you my opinion about some of the solutions. What can we do? What could we do? And part of this talk builds on an input I had to one of Wes Streeting's three working parties to develop the new 10-year plan for the NHS. Which I think were abolished along with the NHS England, so he kind of retracted what we were doing and tried to move on at his own pace. So think about it as insurance, first of all. And that's one of the major, major benefits that the NHS has provided to the UK population, financial security. It gives financial security to the population. However, there are difficulties with social insurance, right? The private insurance doesn't work in terms of universal coverage. There are well-established reasons for that. We can go over that if you wish. But we have to rely on social insurance for universal coverage. But there are problems. So I'm going to give you 10 or so points, 10 or so aims that I think we might follow. I'm not sure I'll be listened to even by Andrew or anybody else, but I think that there are things we can do, and it doesn't rely on reorganisation as such. It relies on a different perspective. It relies on individual policymakers trying to marry up the funding through social insurance with the outcomes. So, picking up on something that Michael said, we're in a fiscal planning cycle of about 5 years. If a government lasts 5 years, it plans for 5 years, and it gives some sort of hand-waving to a 10-year plan. 60% or so of the NHS expenditure goes on the workforce. About half of that workforce takes time to train, more than 5 years. So we're immediately on the back foot. If you've got a 5-year fiscal planning cycle, and a workforce training cycle that takes anywhere up to 10, 15 years for the physicians in the NHS, and greater than 5 years for the specialised nursing force, and the nursing force is the biggest component of the NHS workforce, you're immediately on the back foot. You can't really plan because you don't know if the next government, to pick up on a theme from Andrew, is going to promise you cake but then just take it away. So we have to somehow get the Treasury, and the Treasury are important because they're the biggest player in this room if we think about it in social insurance. We have to somehow get the Treasury to buy into the idea that we want 10-year, at least, funding commitments so that that will align the workforce planning with the fiscal planning. We also want to take it out of politics, right? Andrew said, if you you noted, that NHS England has been abolished and we're back into the Department of Health and the ministers essentially trying to centralise some control of the NHS. That's a mistake because that just brings politics back into the picture, right centrally into the picture. I think we have to establish at least an Office of Budget Responsibility or at least some independent authority which can hold the government to account on these spending plans. And if we don't do that, then we don't have anybody really to give us any oversight about what's actually happening to some of the biggest resource spending in the public sector in the UK. And I think that that oversight ought to be based on thinking about insurance. If we were a private insurance company, we'd be thinking about the risk groups, how we treat the risk groups, how we can follow individual patients through their treatment plans, how we can get patient-level costing detail to give us back to plan the next round of expenditure. We'd need to think about how we get information and costing information on expenditure. We're still not there. The first Royal Commission report in 1956 by Goulabad, who was a Cambridge economist, said essentially when the problem then was that the politicians thought we were spending too much money in the NHS, he said we don't know really how much money we're spending because we don't follow the costs through. So we have to think about insurance and about costs. The second thing is nobody knows what to expect when you're in the NHS. What should I expect as a patient? If I had a, we also know that if it was private insurance, people don't really read the benefits packages. But we ought to at least try to provide some benefits package for diagnostics and treatment within the NHS. We could do that by relying on NICE guidelines, the NICE Institute for Clinical and Social Care Excellence, and the local guidelines in clinical guidance, which proliferate amongst the hospital staff within the NHS. So we could draw that together in a rational plan and then say, giving the GPs extra funding for them to act as the advocate for the patient, once they meet the patient, because that's where most patients meet the patient primarily, once we've diagnosed you, this is or for diagnosis, even for diagnosis, here we start with the journey. If you get to the diagnostic centre, this is what you ought to expect. And this is ought to be the time period within which you should expect the diagnostic test to come back and the information to come back. If it turns out we can do something for you in terms of treatment, here's the expectation of the complete patient pathway with the integrated pathway across different service providers within the NHS that you should expect to contact. And the GP should act as your advocate to do that. So that hopefully would overcome some of the big breakpoints in the NHS. The breakpoints are trying to get a GP appointment, trying to get the GP to refer you, trying to get the first outpatient visit so that the consultant can see you, to then get the second outpatient visit to then try to admit you into the hospital if that's necessary, to then discharge you and liaise with social care. Every point is broken. It takes time. Whereas if we could try to integrate it through a contract, which was given to every patient at every episode, as would happen with private insurance, then I think we could overcome that. And we could rely on national institutions to do that, NICE and also the local institutions. Prevention, Andrew or Michael mentioned prevention. We talk a lot about prevention. Prevention's currently seen as an expenditure. In fact, if we just moved in the accountancy tables of the NHS, prevention as an expenditure into an investment income, move it into the income column rather than investment, the expenditure column, it would actually protect the income given to prevention. Sounds simple. Move it from one column in the accountants into the into another column in the accounts. There are means to do that. If you look at the slide, there are various ways in which we could do that within the public sector, really through the Financial Act of 1987, to try to move prevention expenditure so that it's seen as an investment rather than an expenditure. But if we try to do it more generally, you'd have to change accountancy rules. And if you change the accountancy rules, that's a big ask. There are currently quick fixes that the Department of Health could put in place, which they do for certain capital investments, which have short-term returns, but they want to promote them. They do that through this restructuring in the public dividend capital, which follows from this act. So they could do it. There is a mechanism there, but it's never been thought of. What's the fourth aim? The fourth aim is really to improve primary care. As Michael pointed out, there's a mismatch in terms of the investment in the workforce just now. Most of the money's still going into the hospital consultants, and we've got a real problem with primary care. I think that we have to look fundamentally what's happening in primary care. The current regulation relies upon a private company's report, McKinsey, to the past Conservative government, which says there should be about 72 face-to-face appointments per 1,000 patients on your books per week. Now, that's still in place, really, and that's still the sort of regulation that they look to as a fundamental regulation. Doesn't make sense. Face-to-face has been replaced with some virtual consultations. It needs to be updated. It needs to reflect better ways of working and newer ways of working within the GP choice. The choice of GPs is kind of limited to catchment areas. It's not entirely limited in that way, but there should be incentives for GPs to expand. I think we've got real trouble with trying to create these incentives because GP practices are actually contracting. Once we put that funding in place, there ought to be some publicly available knowledge on the full range of GP activities. We don't have very much information even on the number of GPs that are working at any point in time in the NHS. We have to expand the targets and the payments, I think. I think we have to institute patient-level questionnaires. Within the secondary hospital sector, there are about 15 million inpatient hospital episodes per year in England, and 10% of them, 1.5 million questionnaires, are issued to patients on entry into the hospital and on exit to see if there's been any change in their health status over the period that they've been treated. I think we could do that with GPs. I don't see why we shouldn't be getting information on improvements in health at the GP level. And eventually, radical as it is, I'd like to try to get some of the finance that the GPs get, or indeed the integrated care boards if they still exist over time, I'd like to get some of the finance that they get linked to health improvement. Not just throughput, but health improvement. But to do that, you need to get the information. Secondary cares. Again, Andrew and Michael touched upon this. About 60% of all inpatient care within the hospital sector goes through the ICU at present. Most of it is associated with septicemia. Not all of it, but most of it's associated with emergency cases and then ongoing treatment for septicemia. But a lot of it is also used, ICU space, used as recovery room space. People coming out of the theatres, put into the recovery room within the ICU unit to see how they're doing post-operation. That just seems to me to be a mad use of ICU. There has to be some recalibration of that. We have to start to think about how theatres can be better used, but we don't have any good information on theatre time at the national level. In some places, we don't even really know how many surgical theatres there are within a hospital, a trust, not a site, but a trust. Discharges are a mess, as I've already said, and discharges are a mess partly because there's no liaison with social carers, social work. There's meant to be much greater coordination on discharge into the local authorities' care, but in fact it's a mess. And it's a mess because there's no financial budget, there's a very small financial budget in some areas, which are allocated to try to improve discharge practices. I think we have to try to improve that, but I'll come back to that because the elephant in the room is something you're going to hear about from Kate, is social care. Waiting lists have suddenly come to the top of the pile. You know, 7.5 million are waiting for elective care, as Andrew pointed out. So waiting lists are again at the top of the political pile. There's no doubt that we're going to use private health facilities to try to get these waiting lists down. Private health contracts with the NHS are such that private hospitals can refuse to admit NHS patients if they want. So they cherry pick. So unless private hospitals are subject to the same regulation as the NHS hospitals, I don't really think that's a good efficient outcome. And I'd also like to link some of the hospital payments to these quality adjusted life year gain health outcomes where the information is being collected currently and not just the patient flows and throughput. Mental health was touched on by Michael. It's a complete mess. It's a mess not just because, as Michael pointed out, the workforce is not there, but I don't think the workforce really knows what it's doing. I don't think the planning people know what they're doing. So we had the Treasury announce the budget in November or December last year before any planning was announced for the NHS. So basically the budget's given before you plan. So you have to plan to the budget. And then they said, okay, we're going to have the plan, but then this administration said, well, hang on a minute, we're going to have another budget, spending review, basically a budget. $25 billion was released in the last budget, and I don't know where it's gone. It's probably gone to the waiting list initiatives, but it could be used to increase the capital spend within the mental health area, which is certainly needed. And we could increase the day case association of health centres, which are used primarily to tackle chronic care patients in the mental health sector, to try to get better traction on their patient journey. Nobody really follows up. We have a crisis teams who come in with a crisis but don't actually follow through the patient journey. So we wait until something awful happens and then we initiate care. Some of these, and quite it's a large proportion of these mental health patients, also receive disability benefits. And I think we could tie disability benefits to the treatment. I don't see why not. If you don't turn up for your treatment, which we will initiate within this social insurance plan, that everybody should have a plan and a benefits package, you don't turn up, your benefits get affected. Harsh penalty, possibly. Procurement and costs. We don't have a national system of procurement yet. We've been talking about it for ages. If you think about hips or knee replacement, they're still done at the local level. We still don't know there are three parts to a hip, a ball and a cup and a stem. We still don't know what is the optimal configuration for different types of breakages. All that could be on the shelf, and we could just pull it off the shelf at economies of scale, negotiated bargaining, to get the manufacturers to give us the best price. We don't have it. We should be using the size of the NHS to improve our procurement practices. As the National Audit Office said, the supply chain's not working. And I come back to the idea that we should have patient-level costing systems. This should be the focus of this digital movement. Instead of the NHS app, very good as it is, we should actually put information on the system about patient journeys which can be joined up. We don't do that. Workforce planning, another mess. We seemingly have a workforce plan, but they're not enacting it. Most of the extra money that was released for the NHS within the budget in November will be eaten up just by the workforce planning, so we won't get any extra gain, any extra traction. We can tell you how many people work in the NHS. We can't tell you precisely what they do. We don't even know what their hours are. Many of the NHS workers work more than their contracted hours, but we don't take any notification of that. We don't know what they're doing. And that's in secondary care. For GPs, we have no idea. Again, I can tell you how many GPs there are in terms of FTEs, but we have no idea how long they're working. All of the information comes from payroll, which doesn't really help us in terms of workforce planning. And some staffing practices are just well out of date. Sack the managers. We've got too many of them. That's the headline, right? But actually, if you think about social insurance, you want a lot of administrators to administer the information on a daily basis that's coming through to help you track what's happening efficiently and effectively and ineffectively to patients. So you need administration, but then on top of that, you also need managers who are there to think strategically. If you don't have any strategy, some hospitals do, some GP collectives do, but not all of them, you need better investment in the management. And this quick knee-jerk reaction to say, okay, it's easy to sack a manager, it's not so easy to sack a physician, just sack the managers, it's just knee-jerk, and it's unnecessary, it's not thought through. And last but not least, and morphing into Kate's talk, is the elephant in the room, social care. How many people like paying taxes? Well, if you don't pay taxes, you don't get social insurance. If you don't get social insurance, you don't get the NHS. You don't get the NHS, you definitely don't get social care. And I could see maybe a dozen hands go up here. Tax everybody. We're not going to raise much in revenue in terms of taxing the rich, but you definitely don't want to buy into the Tory tax plans and then say you're not going to raise any more revenue, and then find it extraordinary that you can't fund the NHS. That's who the NHS, the UK people have voted in as an improvement upon the last law. Social care, I think, it also has to be seen as a social insurance system. They have that in the Netherlands. Doesn't work perfectly, but it operates relatively well. And until we start thinking about notions of how social care can be improved, we're still going to have all the discharge problems and the repeat visits into the NHS of our population. And of course, being in a university, everything should be backed by evidence and piloted before introduction. Thank you.
So our final speaker is Dr. Catherine Henderson. She's an assistant professorial research fellow at the Care Policy and Evaluation Centre here at LSE. She holds a PhD in social policy from LSE, an MSc in health policy planning and financing from LSE and the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, and two bachelor's degrees from the University of Toronto in Canada in both occupational therapy and English literature. Her research interests include psychosocial interventions for people with dementia, the cost-effectiveness of assistive technologies in managing long-term health and social care needs, intermediate care, residential care provision, and resource allocation in residential and nursing homes. Prior to taking her master's degree, she worked as an occupational therapist in both NHS and social services, both here and in Canada. And Dr. Henderson will discuss the interface between health and social care with a focus on England. Catherine, the floor is yours.
You are hard asked to follow, but I'm following. So I'm Catherine Henderson. I work at Care Policy and Evaluation Centre. Sorry, speak up. I'm Catherine Henderson. I work at Care Policy and Evaluation Centre at the LSE, and I'm going to talk a bit about social care in the NHS. And because I've got very vocals, I've got a lot written down on my sheet of paper here. So I'm going to give a bit of an overview of historical challenges in this area, recent developments and current challenges, and some thoughts on policy. I think we've talked a lot about the NHS. You know, it's, I was going to say funded from general taxation. Well, it is. It's free at the point of access, and many of their services are provided in-house by directly employed staff. But social care is a little different. It's administered in large part by local authority social service departments, which get their funding from local government taxation and social care precept, off your council tax, and from transfers from central government. It's often defined in terms of long-term care, you know, typically personal care for people with difficulties with activities of daily living. But the remit is much broader than that. It includes information provision, safeguarding, and employment support. It involves other sectors and government departments, such as education, criminal justice, and housing. It's not just provided by councils. It features a mixed economy of care with paid care and support primarily provided by private and not-for-profit and voluntary organizations. There's about 1.7 million adult social care jobs, so there's more than there are in the NHS. And the system is underpinned by a huge amount of unpaid work by carers, who are often relatives, but also friends and neighbors, and their work is worth at $184 billion, more than five times the expenditure on English social care currently. So I'm going to focus now on some historical and ongoing challenges posed by the health and social care funding divide, and then move on to current solutions or lack thereof. So the divide springs from social care access being mostly based on need and ability to pay, the means testing, as we call it, whereas NHS access is based on the need for care. Administrative, financial, and professional arrangements have influenced the present organization of our modern health and social care system. In particular, we had two key pieces of legislation in the past, the 1946 NHS Act, which gave us gave the NHS responsibility for acute and continuing nursing care, and the 1948 National Assistance Act, giving councils responsibility for residential and home-based services. They had overlapping responsibilities from the beginning, but over time, people who once might have been cared for in the NHS, long-term care institutions, have moved into council-funded residential and nursing home care. People with short and long-term care needs for health and social care, trying to access appropriate care, have ended up on the receiving end of these boundary issues. I mean, for instance, issues with the supply of short-term restorative support, those provided by NHS and social services in what can be a piecemeal system with variable eligibility criteria, and obviously variations in funding for long-term care in terms of access to NHS continuing care, which depends on one's health condition and where one lives, and we get into the rise of postcode lotteries. So often these boundary problems are framed in terms of the consequences of for the NHS in terms of emergency hospital admissions and delayed discharges, and NHS imperatives have driven so much of the policy making on social care and continue to do so, let's face it. But now we face demographic change that really exacerbates all those issues. We have this growing older population, a doubling of people aged 85 years and older by 2047. The number of people living with dementia is set to have doubled between 2015 and 2040. And social care spending looks set to have increased by 93% between 2018 and 2038. Where solutions have been proposed and implemented, these have generally focused on integrating health and social care services for people with short-term needs, with policymakers looking to integration to solve what are really long-standing NHS problems in managing the utilization of the acute care system. And there are many possible integration routes. Obviously, it's a whole entire talk on its own, but I've listed these from the least to the most structural solutions. We've got cooperation just based on trust, understanding rules, not cost-shunning between organizations. We've got coordination using single point of access, a contact person. We've got co-location, for instance, discharge hubs, bringing hospital and social services staff together. And we have cross-appointed commissioners that are able to buy services from pooled NHS and social service funds. All on the supply side, and then on the demand side, there could be more so personal budgets, so people could purchase their own mix of care that really suited their needs from health and social care. And over the years, much legislation has been introduced to achieve integration. I've listed some of those in the footnote. And there have been new funding mechanisms. Most recently, the Better Care Fund, set up in 2015 to encourage integration, as it requires NHS and local authorities to pool their budgets for care and agree plans to spend them. And some of a proportion of NHS funds are mandated to be contributed to local authorities for social care within each ICB area. And the fund has been criticized for being focused on NHS priorities while doing less than hope to integrate health and social care services, save money, or reduce use of acute hospitals. But it has encouraged joint working processes and can be valuable for supporting unpaid carers by funding voluntary sector and social services supports. On ICBs, we've heard a bit about them, and they are being abolished. But currently, they are boards that have local authority and primary care representatives. They lead integrated care partnerships with wider membership, including voluntary sector, housing, public health, and they're all responsible for agreeing an integrated care strategy. These funding and legislative efforts have underpinned efforts to improve access to free short-term services, mostly aiming to avoid hospitalization or speed up hospital discharges. And there is some evidence that these intermediate care, reablement, and rehabilitation services are effective and cost-effective in supporting older people and supporting people who are homeless. And I've put work by several CPIC colleagues in the reference list. So there has been progress in the last 15 years in widening access to the short-term social care support with extra funding, some of it from the NHS. And interestingly, there has been a bit of an increase in the number of people using short-term services between 23 and 24, of 12%. But statistics on delayed discharges from acute hospitals have remained quite stable over the past 3 years. So in that way, you know, you've heard that from others. Where it's inarguable that progress remains to be made is long-term care. Paying the whole cost of long-term care often falls to individuals and families. In England, if you have more than $23,250 in assets, you're on your own, no access to public funding for long-term care. And this threshold hasn't increased with inflation since 2011. If it had, it would be about $32,000. There's a risk of catastrophic care costs for some people. By the previous government's estimates in 21, while mean lifetime care costs for people over 65 would be around 45,000, around 1 in 7 people over 65, they thought would face care costs exceeding 100,000. And at the same time, so this is my animation, I hope it works. There's a growing number of people living with dementia, encountering a fundamentally unfair system. Quoted Simon Baudry at the Kins Fund here. No one is asked about their house value if they need medical treatment for cancer, yet if they need social care because of dementia, that's exactly what happens. And yeah, there's been several commissions on long-term care funding in England, yet the funding system has changed little, with many false starts A national care service was proposed by the last Labour government under Gordon Brown, and legislation for free personal care was enacted but not implemented. Then the coalition government offered more generous means testing and a cap on lifetime costs of $72,000. That was in the CARE Act 2014. It was supposed to be implemented in 2016. It was deferred to 2020. And then in 2022, the last government proposed a cap of $86,000, but changed what could be taken into account under towards lifetime costs. And then they postponed the reforms until 2025. The current Labour government has promised to introduce a national care service again, but will await the Casey Commission recommendations. They are due in 2028. It should be said, Scotland adopted a Royal Commission recommendation from 1999 to introduce free personal care at home and in care homes, and they've had that policy since 2002, so it's not impossible. Also, reforms to long-term care funding really should consider seriously the role of other government departments. Poor, cold, and unsuitable housing contributes to NHS and long-term care costs, increases depression symptoms and long-term care needs. The role of housing needs a lot more attention. And the BCF, the Better Care Fund, does address this issue, but housing supply, quality, and choice for people with social care needs requires much more policy attention and action. So here's my opinions. To tackle the long-standing unfairness caused by separate health and long-term care funding models, it ultimately requires decisions for government and the public whose taxes will have to pay for changing them. And the government needs to work on public understanding of long-term care. Recent polling on social care reform found that most of the public, around 76%, had not heard of the National Care Service. And we're divided about how the government should go about reforming it, how quickly to do it. And unsurprisingly, while 65% said they would prioritize the NHS for increased public spending, it was 26% for social care for older people and 23% for housing. So it just doesn't have this much of a priority. And other research by my CPEC colleagues on planning for one's future social care and priorities for social care funding found that people faced uncertainties in contemplating a really complex system. They lacked advice, not knowing how to save for social care, worries about how good the care was if they got it. They wanted affordable, good quality care. They wanted to contribute to that in advance. They wanted risk pooling arrangements that were fair and transparent. And the other thing is we really need better public understanding of dementia, because there are growing numbers of people living with dementia. They use a lot of social care, and they face inequities in access to NHS continuing care funding. A 2023 YouGov poll for the MBED care study found 94% of 2,000 members of the public didn't know that dementia is the leading cause of death in the UK. And while individuals and family bear the majority of care costs, just 17% were aware of this, most thinking that dementia care is funded by charities. And lastly, just a couple of things. Workforce is, we need a health and social care workforce with appropriate training, sufficient to meet projected health and social care needs, with important decisions to be made on things like whether to recruit migrant care workers and in what numbers. And there is also, lastly, a health and social care data divide, completely separate and different recording systems maintained by NHS organizations and local authorities. And the government should build data sharing across health and social care, in its ongoing plans for improving ICT and social care digitalization. And it actually does look like this will be progressed, in that the current plan being to provide information standards and ensure interoperability using provisions of the 2022 Health and Care Act. So, there's a small positive note to end on. I've given you my excessively long reference list there. Thank you.
So it's now a pleasure to welcome the first of our two discussants this evening. First of all, Professor St. Julian Le Grand. Julian, you're going to talk from there, or do you want to?
I'm going to talk from here.
Okay. So Julian has been a professor in the LSE since 1993. He's currently a member of the Marshall Institute, and he's also taught at universities of Sussex, Bristol, and California. He's an economist by training with a PhD in economics from the University of Pennsylvania. And he's authored and co-authored and edited many books and written over 100 articles, book chapters on economics, philosophy, and public policy. Between 2003 and 2005, he was seconded to No. 10 Downing Street to serve as senior policy advisor to the Prime Minister. And he's also acted as an advisor to the President of the European Commission, to the World Bank, the World Health Organization, the OECD, the Treasury, the UK Department of Work and Pensions, and the BBC. He's been vice chair of Major Teaching Hospital, a commissioner on the Commission for Health Improvement, and a non-executive director of several health authorities. He's also served on grant boards for the Economic and Social Research Council and also on the Leverhulme Research Awards Advisory Committee. Julian was awarded the Upolis Prize for Public Policy in 2012, and his submission for the Wolfson Economics Prize also received a special category prize. And in 2015, Julian was awarded a knighthood for services to social science and public service. Julian, we look forward to your thoughts.
Thank you very much. Well, let me first of all say it is a privilege to be asked to speak at this. We've talked about the 77th birthday of the NHS, but it's also the 30th birthday of NSE Health. And as one of the people who was involved at the beginnings of NSE Health, it is particularly pleasurable to see its growth and success since that time. When I was involved those 30 years ago, I had a simple mantra that actually that would do away with all the nonsense that we've heard so far about solutions to the NHS. There was one simple solution, which was incorporating the word incentives. That the incentives, I echoed the Prime Minister I worked for and talked about the three priorities were incentives, incentives, incentives. In fact, I think it's worth looking back at exactly why the Blair-Brown government was so successful. Full disclosure, I worked for it, so. But why was it so successful? Why did it result in the highest level of public satisfaction historically there's ever been? I might add also waiting lists had dropped to virtually zero and the NHS was financially solvent. Generally it was a story of, I mean, of course there were still problems, but generally a problem of success. Why did it do so? Well, it had two incentive structures built into it. One was called targets and performance management, and which became rather rapidly known as targets and terror. And the other was patient choice for elective surgery and competition with the money following the choice, and hence competition with hospitals to reduce their waiting lists and need more money. The target system was interesting. It was quite terrorising. The Prime Minister every month would hold what we call a stock take. The stock takes would take place in the Cabinet Office. The Cabinet has a kind of the Cabinet Office has a diamond shaped table. The Minister and their ministers there. Civil servants would go and sit around one end of the table. The Prime Minister and his advisers would come in and sit at the front of the table, so to speak. At the other end of the table, the head of the KGB, I mean the head of the Prime Minister delivery unit, would stand, a man named Michael Barber. Michael Barber was described at one point as the most dangerous man in government. But we'll come back to that. He would stand at one end of the table, and he put up a series of graphs that showed just how miserably the department was doing. The Prime Minister would lean across the table and pick up the minister by the scruff of his neck. It's usually him, and I exaggerate, but only slightly. The minister would sob. The civil servants would shiver. They would be told that the Prime Minister would go off and do better or else. And the civil servants and the minister would run back to the department concerned. And incidentally, this wasn't just for health. I mean, it was also done for education, for transport, a whole range of areas. They'd run back to the Department of Health and get on the phone to the hospitals and in real time and say what's happening. and things are better improved or else. And or else often involves the chief executive losing their job or various other penalties around. The choice and competition, patient choice and competition, was also quite effective. There was one study that published in the American Economic Review showed that they reckoned it saved about 3,000 lives during the course of its operation. So we had these were powerful incentives within the system. And the trouble is with most of the ideas that we have, we know where we want to go. We want to shift resources into primary care, or shift resources into social care or whatever. But the incentives aren't there. And at the moment, we've actually moved to a different kind of system, a system integrated care boards, which, if anything, is a monopoly. A monopoly is 42 monopolies. The incentive structure of monopolies, as everyone will know, I mean, whether they're publicly owned or privately owned, is dreadful and certainly does not meet the needs and demands of the users of the service concerned. So, the simple answer is, back to choice and competition and targets and terror.
Okay, and finally then, Dame Jennifer Dixon, who is a visiting professor here at LSE. She originally trained in medicine. She practiced mainly in paediatrics prior to a career in policy analysis. Jennifer has a master's degree in public health and a PhD in health services research from the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. And she's also published widely on healthcare reform, both in the UK and internationally. Between 2008 and 2013, Jennifer was chief executive of the Nuffield Trust. Prior to this, she was director of policy at the King's Fund and was also policy advisor to the chief executive of the NHS between 1998 and 2000. She joined the Health Foundation as chief executive in October 2013. Jennifer has served as a board member for the Healthcare Commission, the Audit Commission, the Care Quality Commission, and most recently, the UK Health Security Agency. She's also led two national inquiries for government, one on the setting up of published quality ratings of the NHS and social care providers in England, and one on the setting up of ratings for general practices. She was also a member of the Parliamentary Review Panel for the Welsh Assembly Government advising on the future strategy for the NHS and social care in Wales. Jennifer received a CBE in 2013 for services to public health and a DBE in 2024 for services to the National Health Service and public health. We look forward to your thoughts now, Jennifer.
So thank you very much, and also to my colleagues here for such interesting insights on the way forwards and the National Health Service. And also grateful for such interest in our National Health Service, which, you know, is it a national treasure or is it a system in crisis? I would say it's certainly a national treasure. And it's also a system, I wouldn't say in crisis, I would say being overwhelmed. And I'll just come back to that in a minute, which draws on what my colleagues have said here. On the national treasure, I was at Westminster Abbey for the NHS's 50th anniversary celebration, the 60th and the 70th. And on the 70th, the bill that formed the National Health Service in 1948 was brought up the aisle on a velvet cushion to the altar. Which health system in the world would receive that treatment? It is a religion. And although it is absolutely true, as Andrew says, that satisfaction of the NHS is at an all-time low, this is, I don't want to quibble, but this was the British Social Attitude Survey with us, I can't remember how many, it's 1,000 people being asked, but actually if you ask, and the question was, are you satisfied with the way the NHS is run nowadays? If you ask people, as people were asked, are they satisfied with the quality of care they receive, that number jumps up to 51%. If you ask the NHS survey, which asks, I think, 700,000 people, and the NHS Star survey, you do get a slightly different result. So I think, although the long range of that survey is important, it's also important to dig into other surveys to show the a more varied picture. Is the system overwhelmed? Yes, it is. And I think Darzi, last October, Lord Darzi, did a very comprehensive review, a diagnostic on the NHS, and set it all out with a 326-page appendix with all the detail and figures you could ever want to have in your slideshow. So please take a look at that. And he said basically sort of three things have injured the National Health Service in recent years. One was austerity following the financial crash, which cut back the real terms increase every year that the NHS received from something like 3.7%, which is its long-run post-war average, to something closer to 1-2% in that period. The second was the pandemic, of course, which injured the NHS like many other health systems. And the third was a rather, what he called, catastrophic reform of the NHS in 2012, carried out, as Ali, I think, was saying, by Andrew Lansley. So that was the diagnostic. Darzi did not give any solutions. That wasn't his job. The solutions are coming out in the 10-year plan, which is due to be published after the spending review after June the 11th. What Darzi didn't major on so much was the demographic wave facing the National Health Service, particularly from the baby boomers my age, who are going to die out in the next 30 years. Big bulge of demography that we have to cope with is a major thing. But he did talk about the health picture in Britain, and in particular the baked-in health problems that are arising from long-run risk factors like obesity, which we will face going forwards, as well as dementia, as you've been hearing about. So lots of issues ahead. So in terms of what we do about this, and I have to say, while the NHS is in a particular pickle at the moment because of the nature of public funding of the system, what we are facing in this country is very similar to what's being faced in many other countries. It's just that we have the chess pieces on a different parts of the chessboard trying to win the game, and other health systems have the same health chess pieces, but probably in different places because of their history and what they've inherited with their systems. In terms of what we need to do to go forward, I'll just point out a few things. The first thing, obviously, and I think number one, bigger than the 10-year plan in terms of solutions for the National Health Service, will indeed be the spending review, which is on the 11th of June. Money is the most important factor which will help the NHS forwards. I actually disagree with you, Julian, respectfully.
I can't imagine.
On the Blair years, you know, the question there is, what was the secret sauce that improved performance over that period? I do think you're right on targets and terror, Julian. But the other massive ingredients, unprecedented more or less in the NHS's history, is the huge dollop of cash that was received by the National Health Service over that period. And I think the analysis I've read, it actually trumped the financial incentives, which will have had an effect, but not compared to the overall. So that's my beef. We can talk about that afterwards.
It didn't happen in Scotland or Wales.
Right, OK.
More amount, more paid.
OK, we will discuss une autre fois after dinner, hopefully. So basically, if the economy sneezes, the NHS catches a cold. That's cliché, that is true, and that is the single most. So what happens with Rachel Reeves, what happens in the next 3 years, is going to be crucial to the NHS's success to be able to cope with these fierce headwinds. Of course, in that, there are incentives we need to talk about, financial incentives, as Julian says, and also, as Ali, I think, said, capital expenditure is going to be critical because of the need for that to spend on kit for IT and technology. So money is the most important ingredient. The second is technology and how we chart a very intelligent path towards developing technology and using it inside the health service that it can sustain it as a model rather than sustain the life science industry where there's a difference, and in particular to up productivity levels that we need to do. If we don't increase productivity, we can't sustain our model. The third is workforce, of course, and the workforce, as you know, has been burned out as a result of the pandemic, as it has elsewhere. But we do have some trust issues, as you see, with the various groups wanting to go on strike, not just about pay, but also conditions and their agency. So I think there has to be a lot more, not just the numbers of workforce, but also how they are managed and treated. The couple of other things, I think, obviously the shifts that Ali talked about, but I think we also have to look at the overall picture for health in the country. As I said, that has the health life expectancy has been stalling, and there has been a worrying uptick in mortality, particularly in left behind areas that are really injuring not both the health service but also the workforce, which the economy depends upon, and of course fixing social care. Back to health, Ali did mention this. We've done some work on how to ring fence, or at least identify how much spend is made on prevention, called PDEL, and a lot of that technical work is being done, Ali, and we've been talking to the Treasury that stuff is published if anyone is interested. It's called Prevention DEL, Prevention Spend, how to identify it in your health system to know whether things are going backwards or forwards. So I think that needs to take place. So just a couple of last points which draw on other colleagues. Two other things, I mean, for the future of the NHS, the extent to which the public really still buy into the model, I think that's going to be very important, and that's why, unfortunately, some of the top of the pile priorities are still top of the pile. Waiting and access is got to be there, and that's why it's number one. But the politics, I mean, you can hear the frustration, particularly from Andy, about the swivel-eyed chop and change of NHS roller coaster policies that come in, can come out, depending on whoever is the Secretary of State. So longer-term stable policy, we were promised mission-based government. This is the 10-year Mariana Mazzucato type of approach to government. Let's see if that comes about. But I do think we're in a kind of post-Legrand, post-modern mush in terms of the overall narrative for the health service. When Julian was in number 10, there was very much a sort of competition and choice shtick that came, I think largely from the Reagan and Thatcher era. That is still valid, but that kind of narrative has faded over time. And instead, if there is a narrative, Julian, which I think is not very strong, it's really focusing far more on the technology that will get us out of the of problems into the future, and less the faith in the market. So I think coherent policy going forwards. But I think the last thing I would say, which I think several of our speakers referred to, is that just to remind everybody that our system has endured through very bad times. We are facing very similar problems elsewhere, as we said. Given that we've got these very fierce headwinds, demography, stalling economies, 0.7% growth, it's not going to deliver 3.7% real terms growth for the National Health Service. A lot of issues ahead of us. We do have very, very formidable assets in our system, which includes some of the things mentioned. We've got an excellent data system, potentially. We've got a system that we can coordinate different parts of the system. We've got extremely good regulatory apparatus, if not a bit overblown. And we have a very significant public and staff commitment to the model itself. These assets can really come into their own in a situation where you need intelligent moves in the system to, as I say, navigate these headwinds, not least through the technology side, and particularly technology. So I do think if we were clever enough, we can array this system and sweat the assets far more as we go into this different era, this 0.7% real terms growth every year in the economy, coupled with this massive wave of technology that we have to negotiate. And I think our system is as good as any, if not better, to try and negotiate that, if only we can stick to an intelligent pathway and not swerve too much. Thank you.
Okay, so it's now my pleasure to open the floor to you for questions. So please raise your hand if you've got a question and wait for a microphone to come to you. If you could say your name and your affiliation, that would be great. And if you could try to keep your questions concise so that we can get as many going as possible. So if we could start here, thank you.
Thank you. I'm Robert Yates. I'm a visiting professor of practice here at the LSE. Absolutely fantastic session. Thank you so much. It strikes me that the main problem is it's a political problem, and we need a political fix. I mean, it was very interesting, Michael. All your graph started at 2010, and it's been downhill since. And what happened in 2010? The Tory government came in to undo all the fantastic work that Julian and Tony Blair and Gordon Brown had done, particularly in doubling public spending. But this has been the history of the NHS. We have this sawtooth funding. The Labour fund it properly, and then we get right-wing governments in who neglect it. But I don't think the British public really want that. And of course, our major worry looking ahead is that we are potentially heading for a Nigel Farage government with like 30% of the vote. And then the NHS might not get to 85. If you look at all the parties, though, I think the balance of power is for funding the NHS properly. And so the solution, surely, would be proportional representation. We change the electoral system so that the Lib Dems, the Greens, the Nationalists, Labour, who all love the NHS and support it, will be in power much more often, and we are much less likely to get right-wing governments in that don't fund it properly.
Who'd like to respond first to that?
Do you agree? That's the question.
Well, I'm strongly in favour of proportional representation. Whether I think that'll solve the problems of the NHS, I'm not wholly convinced. If I may respond also to some of the points that Jennifer made, the question about resources is clearly important. On the other hand, the figures I referred to in terms of the a record of the Blair-Brown government referred to the English NHS. The Scottish NHS and the Welsh NHS and the Northern Irish NHS all received more resources per head than England did, and they all performed substantially worse in the areas that I talked about. In fact, in thank you to Scotland, waiting times went up, and similarly in Wales and Northern Ireland. So I don't think the answer is really resources either. So I'll stop there.
Anyone else want to jump in?
Yeah. I don't really have very much to say on that, Rob, except that it's a question that once again puts politics at the centre and diverts from the NHS.
Yeah, my organisation, the Health Foundation, interviewed every former Secretary of State for Health, and we published in a little book called Windows and Glaziers. It's very interesting. Each of them had 1,000 words to say what insights would they give to a future Secretary of State. And what was very interesting about that book was twofold. The first one is, if you covered over their names and just read what they'd written, you couldn't tell which political stripe they were. In other words, what they brought to the party was very much their own personal stuff, rather than a particular ideology. So that was the first one. But the second one, in the terms of their person, some people were what we called glaziers, and some people were window breakers. Some people wanted to smash everything up. It doesn't work, rip it up, start again, we're streeting. And others were much more iterative, build consensus, take everyone with you, iterate faster, and then you'll get progress that way. Two ends of the spectrum, and it was almost a psychological divide as opposed to a political divide. The issue is that we're swerving from one thing to another, and there's no consistent policy, and it costs, and it's, you know, it detracts, just as everyone has said. So we do need a stable policy making if we're going to have the NHS at 100. And how we do this is, I don't think we can take out politics from the NHS for all sorts of reasons, but there are other ways perhaps of binding agents that can bind people to a longer term strategy, and that's for another day.
Should we take another one? We have a lady here, and then the second one will be there, but we'll go here first.
Thank you. Susan Wolfe, I'm a patient governor at a London hospital and a retired social historian. One of the biggest issues in the NHS, and I've been attending parliamentary health committee meetings for a very long time now, for more than a decade, is that the mistakes in the NHS are costing a fortune. And one meeting I remember, Parliamentary Health Committee meeting, one of the higher-ups in the NHS said, there is no accountability in the National Health Service. It is a culture of blame. When someone in the NHS makes a mistake, they always blame the patient. And this sort of attitude, I mean, the social structure of the country is changing a bit. This sort of sense of doctor knows best is fading a bit. People are starting to challenge things a little bit. The traditional British class system, you know, your betters know what's best for you. But the addressing of these mistakes, I've been told twice I had an advanced cancer. I get radiology reports that say organs appear healthy and normal that were removed 30 years ago and aren't there. And that's costing the NHS, the latest figure I heard was between £1 and £3 billion every like 2 to 4 years. How can we work together as a culture, as a community, with the NHS and with patients to increase the accountability with the, you know, the sort of patient empowerment that's growing and changing with a slightly different demographic as younger people, I think, are not quite so passive about their care.
So, shall I just say something to that, Sarah? Thanks. I mean, I agree. And I mentioned, you know, some of the many tragedies, the catalogue of tragedies that seem to be happen on a very regular basis. Sometimes we do learn from them and do things. Like after the Bristol Royal Infirmary tragedy, things were put in place to try to change the culture of self-regulation and so forth. So sometimes things do happen, but often they don't, as you say. And quite often the mentality, as you say, is to blame an individual. It might be the patient, it might be a rogue individual. You know, Harold Shipman, Lucy Letby. And, you know, people are now, there's a big debate about whether Lucy Letby is guilty or not. She might be, but she wasn't alone. And what the NHS has done, and the Council of Chester, is fail to accept that there must be structural problems that need to be addressed in that institution and many others as well. And instead of focusing on individuals, we need to know, recognise that we're part of a system and actually many of our structures need to change into learning organisations rather than blaming organisations.
So I just want to say that there's an enormous literature on safety culture, I mean, as you can imagine, and some of it my organisation has contributed over the last decade. The climate, fostering a culture, you can imagine what the pillars of a safety culture are: open, transparent, a forgiving leadership structure and management style, a lot of data sharing, whistleblowing culture, you know, there's tons written on this, and yet we still do fall down. The only point I want to make here, apart from that, is to link it back to the targets and terror. Because if you have a kind of management culture that is looking upwards the whole time and is terrified of reporting results, otherwise you get sort of manhandled by the minister or whatever, your monthly stock take, then that is antithetical to the kinds of more open culture that you want, a listening culture where you're actually looking at the shop floor and not up there to your targets. So I think those two things are absolutely linked.
Yeah, I guess I'm looking at this from the clinician perspective, but I still think there's a long way to go in terms of transparency and how we're handling adverse events. So I think a lot of things still get brushed kind of under the carpet, and there's still this feeling that doctors or other healthcare professionals are terrified that they'll be isolated as the individual that is responsible, even though a lot of these are largely system failures. From the kind of educational point of view, I don't really remember being taught about, you know, at medical school, and even integrated into my training about, you know, how you investigate patient safety incidences and, you know, how it's framed and how you implement the findings of these, you know, investigations. And then in terms of pragmatically, another thing I'm reflecting on, having worked in a hospital and secondary care, so Obviously, there is the whole data system. You know, it's meant to be a national system where we report patient safety incidents. The data is meant to be fed back, and to some extent, that does happen. Like it is positive that system has been developed and maintained, and that. But it still remains largely in the hospital. It's not implemented in primary care. So there isn't really much shared learning or data recording in terms of these types of events in the primary care setting. And considering that's where 90% of the patient contacts take place in the healthcare system, there's still a big, big gap there.
Ali, do you want to comment?
It's undoubtedly true that there are huge problems. Or volume of malpractice claims are now at the level that they are at in the UK, USA. Is that not working? Can people hear me?
Yes.
Yeah.
It's undoubtedly true that things aren't working at some level because the volume of malpractice claims in the NHS are on average at a level per annum that they're at in the USA. It's just that the financial compensation associated with these claims are much lower in the UK given the difference in the legal system, or else we'd probably hear more about it. That said, a number of official reports have emphasised the shortage of staffing in the NHS, and I think that is an issue. The level of physician to per capita and nursing per capita varies quite markedly across the country, but also seems to be much lower than most of our comparison countries, if you look at them. So the big scandal about 10 years ago in the maternity hospital was directly linked to a shortage of nurses below the recommended RCN levels. So I think there are some underfunded elements of the arguments which feed through into the staffing shortages, which have some impact, but then also I think there are structural and feedback processes, feedback loops, which aren't necessarily following the types of safety recommendations that Jennifer would suggest.
Could you wait for the microphone so people can hear?
It just seems that we learned as little children when learning to do chores by, you know, from our mothers, that it takes less time to do something right in the first place. And if you'd done your little chore right in the first place, you'd be outside planning by now. So that when I get a radiology report, as I said, that says an organ appears healthy and normal, that was removed 30 years ago and isn't there, that's a waste of time, a waste of resources, a waste of everything, and that's not a matter, you know, how rushed does somebody have to be to notice that somebody's gallbladder isn't there?
We're going to go to our next question because folks can't hear you anyway at the back. There's a question, there was a hand here, yes.
Thank you. Anita Patel, Professor of Health Economics at Imperial College London. Jennifer talked about some of the narratives that sit around all of this, and some of the really common ones are, you know, personal responsibility.
Could you speak up? I can't hear you. So.
Oh, shall I shout?
Yeah.
Okay, so some of the common narratives that we hear are around personal responsibility and that this is a public sector problem, essentially. But I think one of the narratives that still doesn't seem to get as much attention as it really should is the commercial determinants of health. I know we've had work around sugar and alcohol and so on, but things like aviation industry, car industry role, workplace stress, all of those things that are becoming really big determinants of health, contributing to kind of like really high prevalence conditions like dementia. I just wonder whether a bigger narrative around that, a stronger narrative, you know, obviously then brings in other types of funding mechanisms and so on into the conversation.
Thank you. Jennifer?
Yeah, I mean, the I don't know what the percentage is, but commonly it's said that 20% of our health is affected by the NHS and 80% is affected by wider determinants, of which, it depends, but some of which will be related to the kinds of things you mentioned. It's the context in which we live rather than our own individual choices. But the public, we've done quite a lot of surveys of the public here. The public still think that health is a personal responsibility, and if people are ill, it's their fault kind of thing. Shifting that narrative, we've employed a lot of agencies, advertising agencies, to try and help us shift that, to frame the narrative somehow different, so that to try and improve that in the public consciousness. But just to say, I do think the government, your general point, is very tentative on tackling these wider determinants. It's not just the proximal risk factors you mentioned, alcohol, sugar, high-fat sugar, salt, and so on, or even air quality. Also some other things, education, housing, poverty, poor quality work is other ones. Or even standing back even further, panning back, the sorts of things that Martin here has been studying, which is sort of the very toxic effects of deindustrialization over many years, whether it's sudden, as in Eastern Europe, or whether it's a slow burn, as it was in the northeast of England, and mining. So we are just getting to grips with some of this. I think we're understanding it a lot more. But I think if the government was a bit more active on the immediate risk factors, as well as some of these commercial determinants and even social determinants, Michael Marmot style, which is largely public sector sort of factors, we would be able to do that. You need a 10 to 20 year horizon of interest to invest. And that's the issue.
Anyone want to add anything further to that one? Okay, we have one final question, I think, here at the front.
Thank you very much. My name's Erica Richardson. I'm at the European Observatory on Health Systems and Policies, and I work with Martin at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. One of the things, we talked about the NHS and we talked about social care, but nobody actually mentioned palliative care. And with the growing burden of dementia, is it not time for us to reframe that as not a social care issue, but a palliative care issue? And if we're going to do that, how are we going to do it? I suppose it's Catherine, but it's for the rest of the panel too.
Yes, Catherine, do you want to go first?
Well, there are people much more expert than me in this area. I did work on a project with Catherine Sleeman, who's done a lot of work in this area. So I can only agree if we consider that dementia is a long-term terminal condition, then it's a health condition, and you'd have health needs. And then you'd have the right to a continuing care package, which is free. There's been all this work on palliative care plans, and ICBs, I think, were supposed to bring in some, they were supposed to have regard to palliative care planning in each area, because it had been quite, it is very piecemeal, and it's mostly offered by voluntary sector organizations and charities. It's a very interesting area. But again, there is no commitment to saying that dementia is a palliative care. It obviously does require palliative care. I think one of the rather awful things I was reading, writing this talk, was that people actually sometimes live too long with dementia, and they get a continuing care package, which then they are asked, they're told they've lived too long, and they don't deserve the end of life care anymore because they run past, I think it's 18 months, there is some limit to it. So, you know, because dementia is, of course, not a condition, well, a cancer, but, you know, you can live all sorts of different numbers of years with it, depending on your condition and all sorts of other health problems that you might have. So all of those things, yes, I mean, really, it's to consider these health and social care needs in the round as what is appropriate care? What is appropriate care? Wherever it comes from, wherever the money comes from, it ought to be the right care for you.
Michael, the last word's going to be yours.
Oh, that's a lot of pressure. I wasn't expecting. Well, two things on that. One, I think it's important for the inequalities agenda because, you know, the hospices, they're all funded by charities, right? And we know that hospices are working. I've worked in areas of more affluence and lower affluence, and in the more deprived areas, the hospices are very under-resourced. And that has a knock-on effect because it means that people are more likely to end up in a hospital at the end of life. And then I'm also currently undertaking some work funded by the Health Foundation looking at high-cost patients. There's 1% of patients that are responsible for a third of our healthcare costs, looking at mainly primary secondary care costs. And a substantial proportion of these patients are end of life, so they're ending up in hospital. And you know, I know it's anecdotally, but, and I don't really know the full evidence on public preferences, but it's extremely rare that I meet a patient that says they want to die in hospital. So I think there needs to be more of an economic case made about investment in palliative care and the knock-on effects that it would have in terms of hospital expenditure.
Okay, so we're going to draw this part of the evening to a close now. We can continue, anyone who would like to join us on the 8th floor. But now I hope you can all join me in really appreciating and thanking all of the things that we've got. And thank you also to people who have been producing the event as well. Thank you very much. So the water health service.